Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. This is podcast number 15. Now, last week we had Dr. Nicholas Grimes on as an interview. It was actually recorded a little while back. This was the first time we were able to actually air it. And thank you again, Dr. Nicholas Grimes, for letting us talk to you about your Vortex approach. I don't want to waste any time. We just want to catch up where we ended last. We're going to now start talking about how to implement the Vortex approach. And I think this is very useful, especially if your current setting is not using it. So without further ado, let's go ahead and start the podcast. Well, no, that's perfect. I was really hoping that we can kind of get an introduction for people who may not completely understand the graph, or, you know, it's 3 a.m. and they're trying to figure out the graph like I was doing last night, trying to completely understand the changes. One thing I wanted to ask you about, you know, there are definitely the progressive hospitals and departments out there that they're going to see the Vortex approach, or have already seen the Vortex approach and are using it, and they're using the language with it, the verbiage of, you know, we're getting sucked into the Vortex, or all I could keep thinking of in the back of my head is, well, we're going down the drain. But it's important that I think we could also briefly discuss, say it's a new place, or say you're somewhere that doesn't really have this kind of system in place. It's kind of almost operator dependent on how we're going to manage the airway. Do you have any tips or suggestions on how places such as that could potentially adopt the Vortex approach, and how they can best use it for somewhere that may not be at the top of their game on airway management?
Look, I think it's important to recognize, one, the Vortex is a great idea, I think, and a lot of clinicians have said it's sort of intuitive and described it as, you know, the most common comment I get is, oh, look, this is the way I thought about it. I've always thought about it, but I've just never been able to articulate it in that way. So I think there's a face validity to the concept, but there is some background, behavioral psychology elements and, you know, research on human factors that supports a lot of the underlying principles behind what we've done, but there is no evidence for the Vortex actually improving team performance, and we're working on putting a trial together to establish that. So I think that's important going in, that people understand what this is. This is not a proven strategy. It's just a strategy at the moment that seems to have face validity. The second thing is that it is a major shift for some people. One of the things about the Vortex was that, you know, it's sort of having the gall to state the obvious in a way. And everyone knows there are three upper airway lifelines, and then if your best effort at all those fails, there's Kaiko rescue. That's obvious when you talk to people, but no one ever taught it like that. And it's not obvious from looking at the algorithms that there are only three upper airway techniques and then there's Kaiko rescue. That sort of gets lost in the complexity of the sequence of interventions and things that you can do. Some of the terminology and concepts, whilst they're conceptually simple, the language and terminology is all quite new. So I certainly don't say to people, start shouting about lifelines and green zones to a team that hasn't been trained. You know, my expectation is that without training of a team, I wouldn't expect the Vortex to actually improve stuff. In fact, if you start using idiosyncratic language that the rest of the team doesn't understand, you're almost certainly going to derail things. So I think if you want to implement it at an institutional level, you really need to get buy-in at a high level and do team training and get people on board. In the absence of that, it is possible, whilst I think the most benefit comes from it as being a team-based tool where you have everyone, all staff involved in Airway, having a common template and a common language for thinking about things. I think it's still useful, if you haven't gotten to that sort of point where you're able to implement that, to use it on a personal basis, just as a checklist in your mind. If you want, have I had my best effort at face mask ventilation? Have I had my best effort at supraglottic airway? I mean, you can still use it for planning, and you can still use it to prompt yourself mentally, and you can still talk about it to the team using the language that's used in your department. And one of the reasons we made the graphic have icons on it rather than text as it did in the previous version is that Well, the major reason was I think it makes it more memorable and easy to recall. But a side effect of that was it meant that if there is terminology, you know, people say laryngeal mask or supraglottic airway or extraglottic airway or a supraglottic airway device, there's people use different terms for this. And for Kaiko Rescue, there's a million different terms for it, surgical airway and crike and blah, blah, blah. The use of graphics on the tool means that you can sort of stepwise adopt the vortex in your department. If you want to sell people on the concept of just that simple circular graphic and the optimization strategies, that doesn't necessarily include a lot of jargonistic terminology. You can have that, and because of the icons on it, you can refer to each of those lifelines and to Kaiko Rescue. You can refer to that as surgical airway if that's usual in your institution. So it allows you to adopt the underlying concepts of the vortex approach without necessarily buying into the entire lexicon of language that we've put together. But I will say I think ultimately that lexicon for airway management is really important. You know, in ACLS, for example, we have no output, shockable rhythm. These are things, you know, 30 to 2. These are things that state key points of situational awareness that we routinely state to the team. They let everyone get an instant idea of what's going on and what needs to happen next, and enables the team to prepare. That sort of language doesn't currently exist for airway management. So the Vortex has tried to create that. I think trying to push that all at once onto a team can be too much in the absence of a really sort of integrated training program for all members.
I would definitely agree with that. There's a lot of steps to this, and it is something that, you're right, it does have a lot of face validity. It's something that even when I was reading through this, I'm thinking, well, this is all stuff that, again, you see at multiple different resources and you see scattered throughout literature. And so you've got in the back of your mind, but this is so well organized that it's one of those, like, I'm really interested to see when you do have research on it, just how effective it is, because I imagine it's going to be rather effective, especially in a team-based approach. But I've noticed in the last few airways I've dealt with, it's in the back of my mind, that whole concept of the vortex approach. We may not be saying it out loud because not everyone's used to it, but and I think that's somewhere for our department to go, where I work primarily at. But I really do enjoy the way it's set up. And I think one of the big things for me is, you're right, there's not a lot of language like there is in ACLS right now. I think one of the closest things we get to, especially with kind of airway emergencies, is when we get to someone saying, well, I can't intubate, I can't oxygenate, or I'm going to do one more attempt at an ET tube, and if that fails, we're going to move to a crike. But it's not concise. The closest thing is I'm at a can't intubate, can't oxygenate point, which is the you call it Kaiko, correct?
Yeah, look, it's you know, even amongst that term, you know, we went from can't ventilate, can't intubate to can't intubate, can't oxygenate. And then I think the real success of that terminology was what I call the sort of bivowel phenomenon. It turned it into a enunciable word. We could say Kaiko rather than CVCI or can't ventilate, can't intubate. We could just say Kaiko. But the problem is, even with that, there is people say Psycho and Chico and Kiko. And so I talked to Andy Hurd about, and people spell it CICO. I think spelling in a crisis is probably just not a good look. It's certainly not going to be the most efficient way to communicate if you've got to spell. But I spoke to Andy Hurd, who coined the phrase can't intubate, can't oxygenate, and said to him, what do we do? And he sort of agreed with me that we just need to commit to one thing. And we thought that Kaiko was the best pronunciation, and we sort of pushed that as a sort of consistent pronunciation. But you know, it's interesting, you know, just on that small thing, how hard it is to get consistency across everything. I think one of the, you know, you were saying before, can't oxygenate. You know, one of my pet peeves is that the term oxygenate is not really well understood by people. When you ask people, okay, you can't oxygenate, what do you mean? How do you assess that you can't oxygenate? That can go from anything between I can't get a CO2 trace to the sats are falling to the patient is bradycardic. And there might be, you know, in a well-pre-oxygenated patient, there might be 10 minutes between those different events. So the, you know, the trigger for can't oxygenate in most people's minds is very unclear. And more alarmingly, a lot of clinicians don't realize it's very unclear until you specifically ask them what they mean by can't oxygenate. They haven't really thought about it. So one of the issues is that we really need to have an absolutely clear trigger for what they mean. And I think the problem with the term can't oxygenate, people associate it with falling saturations. With apneic oxygenation and effective pre-oxygenation, if you look at a case like the Elaine Bromley case, now she wasn't pre-oxygenated, but a case like that in someone who was fully pre-oxygenated, an elective, well, normal body habitus patient, she may well have stayed saturated for 5-10 minutes and had sats of 100%, but not be able to deliver fresh oxygen. Now, that desaturation is coming. Pre-oxygenation and apneic oxygenation change how much time you have until that desaturation is coming, but it's still coming. And unless you absolutely know the patient's going to wake, then you need to look at moving forward and doing Kaiko rescue. And it's a whole other discussion, but I think it's that what is the trigger for Kaiko rescue is really important to have clear in your mind. You know, in ACLS, we have a clear trigger of what makes us start chest compressions, but it's much foggier what makes us perform Kaiko rescue. The other thing, just going to concise terminology, I've found that the term green zone has been the most powerful thing out of the whole vortex, because you know that is really a critical moment to realize you're able to deliver oxygen to the alveoli. You know, there are a lot of airway cases that go wrong from not recognizing that opportunity and that momentum that develops in clinicians to keep repeatedly instrumenting the airway and turn a can oxygenate situation into a can't oxygenate situation. The beauty of the green zone concept is it concisely articulates that in a way everyone understands. And as we started to teach this in a simulated setting, we realized that the airway assistants, the nursing staff or anesthetic assistants, were very comfortable to say, you know, when someone would get a CO2 trace and the sats would come up a bit, and they'd say, okay, well, give me another blade, give me a different blade, I'm going to have another laryngoscopy and get this tube in, that we found that the anesthetic assistants were very comfortable saying, well, hang on, are you sure that's what you want to do just yet? We're in the green zone. Do you want to stop and think? And that the response of the airway operator, the person instrumenting the airway, to that prompt was not to feel challenged or threatened, but was actually relief to think, actually, yeah, I've got some time here. I could ring and get some friends, or we could get some more equipment in here, or we could just stop and do this and wake the patient up, depending what the circumstances is. And as you say, whilst there are ways to describe we are getting a CO2 trace and the sats are rising, it's cumbersome. But to be able to say green zone seems to be something that people intuitively understand. This is a sort of situation of relative safety, and it's a non-threatening way to sort of prompt that and recognize the opportunities it presents.
I really like the green zone comment. For me, that I think that's something you can use even without everyone knowing the vortex approaches, because again, it's that stoplight sort of signal, like, okay, I've got the green light, like, okay, we're good for a second. One thing I just wanted to clarify, at least your opinion of, what would you consider a can't oxygenate? You kind of mentioned it indirectly, but I just wanted a nice clear outline of consider.
So that. I think you got to think, the question you got to ask is, I can't oxygenate. What is it I can't oxygenate? Can I not oxygenate the tissues? Can I not oxygenate the blood? Can I not oxygenate the alveoli? And by oxygenate the alveoli, again, there's ambiguity even in that. Do I mean a well-oxygenated alveoli which have a high concentration of oxygen in them, which could happen at the end of pre-oxygenation despite now having an obstructed airway? Or does oxygenate the alveoli mean the ability to deliver fresh oxygen to the alveoli? Now, my opinion is that can't oxygenate means I can't achieve alveolar oxygen delivery. I can't deliver fresh oxygen to the alveoli following my best effort at all three of the upper airway lifelines. And the reason for that is the only thing that airway, there's some ambiguity in what that means. Is oxygenating, the alveolar oxygenated means that they have a high concentration of oxygen in them, which could be achieved following pre-oxygenation despite now having an obstructed airway? Or does it mean that you are able to deliver fresh oxygen to the alveoli. Now, I use alveolar oxygen. I try to avoid the term alveolar oxygenation for that reason, and I use the term alveolar oxygen delivery of fresh oxygen to the alveoli. And my view on the trigger for Kaiko rescue is that if failing your best efforts at all three upper air lines, you are unable to establish alveolar oxygen delivery, if you are unable to establish delivery of fresh oxygen to the alveoli, then that's the trigger. Because, and the reason for that is that all of the interventions associated with airway management are directed at that. That's the only thing we influence with airway management. We establish a patent airway and we deliver fresh oxygen to the alveoli. Subsequently, if your sats are high or low, that's related to different things. You know, having sats of 100% doesn't mean you are delivering oxygen to the alveoli. It means at some point you were, and you may or may not be now. But if you don't have confirmed alveolar oxygen delivery following your best effort at all three lifelines, then you need to do something to establish that, because if you don't, desaturation is inevitable, and so you don't want to waste that time. So I look at it that if you have recognized the inability to get an airway by one of the upper airway lifelines early enough that the sats are still high, then that shouldn't be a deterrent to doing Kaiko rescue. That's a bonus. That means you can now do it. You've got a bit more time, and therefore you're hopefully a bit calmer with a bit more fine motor control, and therefore more likely to be successful at doing this procedure.
Well, that's perfect. That's what I was hoping to get a good answer on. I feel like we've covered a lot today, and especially with your vortex approach. I mean, like I said, we can talk about that for, I'm sure, hours more. And you've got some other different approaches to things I'm really curious about too. But like I said, we may have to save that for another day, just because we've already spent a while talking today. Did you have any other things you want to, you know, briefly mention, some kind of closing remarks or anything you want to make sure you specifically covered?
No, as you say, I think we've covered a lot there. So I've had more than my fair share of airtime.
All right. Well, like I said, hopefully in the future we can maybe talk about some other parts of the topic, or maybe other people will have other questions for us, so we may have to revisit and rehash some of the details. Which, speaking of, if you do have any questions, you can go to our comments. You can talk to us on Twitter. Or you can go to totalem.org and go to our podcast for this episode, in which case you can send your questions there. Also, I'm sure Nick would be happy to have some ways of contacting him directly. Do you have a preference on what you like?
Yeah, if you people go to vortexapproach.org, there's a contact link there, and you can email me through that.
All right, perfect. Well, again, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you on here. This will probably, because of the length of it, we're probably going to break it up in two parts, so it's a little more easy to digest. But we'll be releasing it here in the very near future. Otherwise, like I said, thank you very much, Nick. You've been an excellent guest, and hopefully we can get you back on here some other time to maybe talk about some other parts of this.
Love to. Thanks very much, Chip.
And that ends our interview with Dr. Nicholas Crimes. Again, Dr. Crimes, thank you very much for coming on to the show and talking to us about your vortex approach. Which reminds me, if you have something that you would like to talk about in an interview, just like we had with Min LeCong, Jim DeCanto, Jeff Jarvis, and Nicholas Crimes, go ahead and message me or send me an email at thetotalem@gmail.com, and we would be happy to have you on the show. I know there's lots of different things that are coming down the pipeline. We've talked about it before. Still looking for some people who may be interested as co-hosts. If that's something that intrigues you or you want to help out in any other way, just let me know. Again, you've got my email. You've probably seen our page, hopefully, if you're interested and you've looked at it. Don't forget that if you could please follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, rate us on iTunes, do whatever you can. Every little thing helps to help spread the word. Don't forget to mention it to your friends. Everything you do helps us out too. And the more that we can hit, the more people that we can help out, the better. Sounds like we've just got that time. And like I said, we're going to try and keep this one as short as possible. So until the next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.